All right, you're in for it now. Okay, so next on the line, Melissa Aronchik is an associate professor of media studies at the School of Communication and Information at Rutgers University, the co-author of A Strategic Nature, Public Relations and the Politics of Environmental. She holds a PhD from New York University and has researched corporate greenwashing and how PR affects our ability to communicate about climate change. She's recently been working on a multi-year study on the networks, narratives, and the strategies that industrial groups use to promote action or lack thereof around climate change. Next, we have Brianna Draxler, a senior editor at Yes Magazine, where she manages coverage of climate, environment, and native rights. She has a master's degree in environmental journalism from the University of Colorado Boulder and is a previous SCJ board member. And last on the line is Jenny Splitter, the managing editor of Sentient Media, award-winning journalist covering food, agriculture, science, climate, and health for Guardian, Vox, Unguard, Popular Mechanics, Washington Post, New York Magazine, and she's also the co-founder and a contributing editor to SciMoms. Cool. So thanks all the panelists for being here. Thanks for you listening. And people have asked me why I wanted to do this panel. The solution journalism is very popular. A lot of people really love it. It's a hot topic right now. So I want to give a quick intro as to why it is I felt like this was something worth talking about. For those of you who don't know, the Solutions Journalism Network is one of the big promoters of this topic. They define solutions journalism as a rigorous reporting on responses to social problems. SOJO, as it's so often called, promises that solutions stories get more reads, they get larger audiences, they garner more engagement. They also offer grant funding to newsrooms that do solutions journalism. And of course, that looks pretty good for cash-strapped newsrooms across the country and the world today. Which might be why it's exploded in recent years. Between 2019 and 2020, the number of newsrooms who have been doing solutions journalism doubled. I think there's now, these numbers, don't quote me on these, these numbers are probably more than 400 newsrooms these days that are actively pursuing solutions journalism. There have been more than 3,000 journalists who have been received formal training on it. They're the BBC, Politico, New York Times, The Post, FBR, High Country News, Fast Company, and all of these many, many small town outlets all over the country. Publishers devote specific coverage to it. New York Times had a column for a long time. I think it might have stopped, but it's called Fixes. The Washington Post has a climate solutions vertical, which I'm working on a story for right now. There's also solutions journalism in academia. As of 2022, there were four universities across the country that became official solutions journalism academic hubs. They include Stony Brook, University of Georgia, Northwestern, and Arizona State University. So it seems like everybody's on board with solutions journalism. And yet, as a journalist, every time everybody seems to be on board with anything, I start to wonder what's going on here. Which is maybe you just want to better understand this thing. That's why I wanted to have this conversation. So we want to understand where solution journalism comes from, who it serves, and what it means for our society. Quick last anecdote. I was driving down the road. I live in Colorado. I was driving recently, and CPR came on, and there was this advertisement. One of the journalists popped on the radio and says, like, "We cover the problems, but more importantly, we cover the solutions." And that really hit me. And so I want to start with Jenny at the end of the table and say, Jenny, are the problems really more important? Are the solutions really more important than the problems?
Okay, can you hear me? Yes. So I think I'm going to answer it this way. But I think, like, done well, a good solution story should illuminate the problem and really, like, you know, provide accountability and kind of give us a path forward. The problem, as I see it, is that, you know, there are lots of, you know, quote-unquote solution stories that don't do that. And I'm happy to talk more about that, but that's my answer.
They don't do that.
That don't, like, actually cover that don't eliminate the problem, I would say, accurately, that don't really say, like, how, really interrogate the solution itself. Like, does this solution work? Does it solve... What problem does it solve? I think that's a big starting point. Like, what problem does it solve, and what problems does it not solve, and how well? And, like, especially, like, my, you know, focus and my passion is climate and food, and we're going to need lots of solutions. You know, researchers tell us we're going to need lots of solutions all at once to kind of break down emissions. And so it's really essential that we that readers get an accurate view of like all of these solutions, how well do they actually work, you know, and where do they fit in the bigger picture, because we're not going to have just one solution that fixes everything, right?
I feel very formal with this microphone, I'm sorry.
I know. It's kind of like, you can take it off the stage.
It's adjusting my whole life here. Okay, so I'm curious about where solution journalism comes from, why it's become so popular recently. Something that I've noticed is there seems to be a shift within the industry from doom and gloom to more positive news. I'm thinking about David Wallace Welch, who basically built his career telling us that we're all screwed imminently, and has recently changed his tune, and now is saying, you know, that we need to be changing the narrative and being more positive about things. Yes Magazine has been around since, I think, like 85 or something, and has been doing the positive news since that entire time. So, from your perspective, why are we seeing this shift towards positivity now, and does it have anything to do with the recent rise of social?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. You're very welcome. I was not at Yes Magazine when it began, so I can't speak to like the world of the 90s and the solutions that were happening then. But I think in our world today, there's a few things going on. I think the idea that like that old school notion that it needs to bleed to lead just isn't really relevant and doesn't resonate with readers the same way it did. We get our news in very different forms today, and I think as people are scrolling through social media, the things that grab our attention and that people actually want to share, like, yes, controversy, but also, like, hope, inspiration, I think that is a powerful thing that people want to identify with and put out in the world. I also think about it through the lens of, like, my particular beats with climate, environment, and Native rights. We've seen pretty clearly that like telling people the terrible story of climate doom like hasn't worked. Like it's not a matter of giving people enough information and sharing enough data for them to understand the scope of this like destruction we're causing. So like, okay, we know that didn't work. What else can we try, right? So I think there's a certain hunger for like, okay, how do we actually communicate meaningful change? How do we actually talk about climate in a way that resonates with people? And so I think to me, as a human, that is why solutions journalism appeals to me, is that it feels like we're actually talking meaningfully about these issues and not just leaning on the data and the science to speak for itself.
I've got some concerns with what you said, but I'm gonna hold off on this until okay. Still on this topic of where this stuff comes from, Melissa, and I think you disagree with me on this, but I feel like there's been a recent rise in NGOs trying to address, and government agencies too, but and a lot of private businesses especially trying to address a lot of the ills in the world today. And I wonder if that has had something to do with the rise in stories about these places.
Okay. Thank you. So just first to clarify, I'm not a solutions journalist, and I don't even do research on solutions journalism per se. What I do is research, especially how corporations and their PR intermediaries, their marketers, and so on, come up with solutions to climate change and give those to journalists. So my take is just a little bit shifted to the left of solutions journalism per se. And so from that perspective, business has always been in the business of coming up with solutions to problems. Or maybe a better way of putting it is, business is in the business of coming up with solutions to problems that may not even exist yet. They create the problems to create demand for their product, which they then offer as the solution to the problem. And their expertise, you know, gets rolled up into that too. So they're offering their expertise, you know, look to them to solve the problem. And you know, this has a very long legacy, actually. When I teach my undergraduate students, you know, I often use a classic example of deodorant and mouthwash to, you know, talk about how products were invented to solve problems that didn't even exist. Deodorant and mouthwash invented in the early 20th century and then marketed to people by suggesting that they'd be social outcasts or wouldn't get a job if they didn't use those products. And those are good examples because What we see in those ads is an attempt by business to connect its solutions to the prevailing values or beliefs of the era. So we can imagine the early 20th century context of urbanization, people living in closer quarters, moving into cities, losing their old habits, and being concerned about fitting in, being concerned about getting a job in the city, and so on. And so as solutions journalism has gotten more popular, especially around environment and climate, so has the interest by companies and their PR firms and advertisers to promote their solutions to the climate crisis or to environmental problems. And they do that by focusing on their products and their innovations so that they can be part of the conversation about environmentalism, what it means to us, and what to do about it. But the point I really want to stress here is just that this is a long-standing phenomenon, and I think that's important because we really want to remember that companies have been doing this solutions promotion for a very long time, and they're very good at it. And unfortunately, they're usually 10 steps ahead of journalists on a lot of the issues that journalists are then trying to cover when it comes to climate or environmental issues. I can say more about that as we get further into the conversation.
Sure. Thanks. Okay, so kind of building off of something I think you guys said, Brianna, about the negativity and how it kind of paralyzes us from action. This is just one study, and as a journalist, I should know better than the cherry paper. I'm going to do it anyway. So in 2017, a study from the Commonwealth Virginia University, Virginia Commonwealth University, rather, found that, I'm going to quote this, reading about an effective solution did not impact readers' behavior, intentions, or actual behaviors. This suggests that solutions-based journalism might mitigate some harmful effects of negative conflict-based news, but might not actually inspire action. As someone whose whole the ethos of Yes Magazine is offering solutions to help build a better world, I think is part of the motto, do you worry that solution stories let readers off the hook or cause complacency?
Yeah, absolutely. I worry about this every day. I think that some people read our stories, they have a sigh of relief. They're like, excellent. Someone is doing something about this. I'm off the hook. I'm good, right? Like, the world is getting better, and I don't have to do anything about it. So I do think there's a certain amount of, like, anxiety and guilt are very powerful motivators, right? Like, they are natural reactions to the fact that we are ruining our climate. Like, that is a natural, healthy response, and so those are often necessary to get people to act, and so I feel that. And I also think that sometimes we need to be able to see the world we want to live in order to bring it into being. So by writing stories that envision or like demonstrate communities that are making positive change, I do think what it does is it gives us an idea of what to work toward and gives people a sense of what is possible. And I think that can be much more motivating. I don't think always, right? I think many people read a solution story and then are just able to sleep more soundly than doom scrolling.
Don't we react more when we see a fire bearing down our communities or floods overtaking farmland? Doesn't that inspire us to suddenly care?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, but they're happening all the time. Like, our world is on fire, and still, like, we're not making meaningful moves toward addressing climate solutions, right? So I think it's both. I think there's also just, like, we can only take a certain amount of bad news before we're, like, incapacitated. I was in the trauma-informed climate session yesterday, and they were talking about, like, your window of tolerance, and you can handle so much, and then you either shut down or you, like, go nuts. And I think it's, like, we need a balance of good news and bad news to, like, keep people in a safe and healthy space just in terms of their existence and their mental well-being. So I think that's part of what I try to do with the stories I edit.
Jenny, do you think of yourself as somebody who does journalism with the intent of affecting change?
I feel super uncomfortable with that. And I think it's just like, I don't, you know, once we put a, I don't know, maybe it's my own neuroses, but like once we put a story out into the world, like, I don't know what people are going to do with that. So I try my best. I want us to, like, hold, you know, people accountable, hold corporations accountable, hold the government accountable, you know, with facts and evidence. I want to do that as best I can, and I hope... I also see change as, like, very incremental. I'm very, like, practical in that way. Like, whatever, for better or worse, I'm not, like, really, like, a in the streets advocate. I'm just, like, feel like dietary change is, like, one of my passions, but I'm, like, clearly that's not going to happen overnight, and, in fact, we're mostly going in the wrong direction. So I'm pretty clear-eyed about the fact that, like, I think if we're, for a lot of these, like, you know, big changes that we need to make to sort of adapt to climate change or mitigate emissions, that we need to have kind of incremental changes. So I guess I see, like, each story as maybe, like, a little nudge. I like nudge theory a lot. I don't know. I know there's some, you know, criticisms of that whole concept, but that's kind of the way I see things, you know, holding people accountable, holding, and getting facts out there, and then hopefully that maybe nudges people just a little bit in the right direction.
What's your criticism of nudge theory?
It's
on my list of questions.
I know, how dare you? I'm trying to remember now because I like it so much. I think partly it's just like that some people see it as a. Someone I probably knows more than me is like, oh my god, Jenny Slitter's so stupid. She doesn't know all the ins and outs of the criticisms of nudge theory. But I think it's that it's perhaps like a some more simplistic way of looking at things, right? That like maybe some of the evidence might not add up to us, like what we can nudge behavior forward. Like it works better in some circumstances than others. I think, don't quote me on that. Not a scientist.
Sorry to do that.
How dare you?
I don't know. I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Okay. So talking about action and nudging people towards doing something, I'm thinking about the way that businesses take advantage of that. Specifically when it comes to the role of the individual, this is obviously a really hot topic, getting individual people to fix climate change, you know, with your car, what you eat, or something like this. We're always being told that one of these solutions might, if not solve the problem, at least help to solve the problem. So for Melissa, journalists are always looking for ways to make stories appeal to individual readers, obviously. How do companies take advantage of the individual's role in solving the climate crisis to make things that they can sell?
Well, we know advertising's appeal to individuals is part of the great American myth. It's, we're a nation of proud individuals, we forge our own paths, we go our own way, we find our own freedom. I mean, look at any car or truck commercial that's come out in the last, 30, 50 years. They're almost never about carpooling to work. They're about driving alone up a mountain or speeding along a lonely road, right? So, and this is really embedded in our consumer mindset. We live in a consumer culture, which means that we build our identities, we build our sense of self through consumption, through buying stuff. And environmentalism is a very good marketing opportunity. It's profitable to sell environmentalism to consumers. I have a colleague who's writing a book right now on the outdoor market, so like REI and North Face and all that stuff, and what that teaches us about nature. How, again, we ourselves need to go, we need to go out into the mountains alone with our gear that we've just purchased and have our own experience with nature, can't be like anyone else's and so on, in our car or our truck that we just purchased. they're promoting the way, a lot of these marketers, a lot of companies are promoting the idea that you can buy your way out of the climate crisis. And obviously, the story is the opposite, because the last thing we need right now is more consumption. I think we need a lot less consumption, and I'd love to see some more journalism stories that focus on less growth, less consumption. But beyond the image campaigns, I think it's important to talk about how it's also economically more valuable for companies to promote individual level solutions, because it lets them off the hook from making the kinds of large scale or long term changes to their business that would actually constitute real climate action. So the story of plastic recycling that I think a lot of people know, there's been some fantastic reporting on the story of plastic recycling. That's a story of companies coming up with a solution in the 1980s to concerns that they would have to rethink their production model. It was a lot easier for them to continue manufacturing plastic and just encourage people to recycle it than it was for them to actually manufacture their products not using plastic. And if I can, I mean, I have a bit of an anecdote here, but I think it's relevant. For the book that Stephen mentioned, The Strategic Nature, we did a ton of interviews. And one of the interviews was, thank you, the prop. One of the interviews was for the PR lead for a coalition called the Progressive Bag Alliance, which was an industry coalition of plastic bag manufacturers. So it's not bottles, but bags. And you know, this public relations guy told me about how this Progressive Bag Alliance was underwritten by the American Chemistry Council, the largest chemical trade association in the United States. And it emerged, or it coalesced, after San Francisco passed a law banning plastic grocery bags, which then spurred a lot of copycat legislation in 48 other states in the US. And the coalition essentially analyzed why people were interested in the plastic bag, like what was it doing for them, how did they perceive it, who might not like that, what was the backlash, and then they prepared a really sophisticated campaign called the Bring It Back campaign, where they went to stores and got the stores to have something set up, you know, after the cash, which said, you know, bring back your plastic bags, but also people need plastic bags. There's a whole other argument about how older people like plastic bags, people with pets like plastic bags, so not everyone's on board with plastic bags. Meanwhile, they're doing a ton of lobbying behind the scenes. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that I think is really, when we start talking about recycling as a solution, you know, I want us to start thinking about these larger contexts for action where recycling is actually maybe a problem, and we need to start thinking about other ways to come up with solutions.
That's your follow-up.
How well do you think journalists understand the role of PR in selling these ideas? And have you, in your experience, have we done a good job of parsing that out, seeing the wizard behind the curtain?
I have a really long answer to that question, but I don't want to monopolize it. I have lots to say on this topic. So, okay. First of all, I want to say, like, this journalists are fantastic, amazing people. They know a lot about public relations. You know, there's been some really important, great reporting on PR itself and what it's done. So with that in mind, I do think that journalists vastly underestimate the impact of public relations and lobbying, especially for fossil fuel companies, on their work. And one reason for that is I think that PR people do a lot more than just spin or disinformation or propaganda or what have you. And I think a lot of journalists see it in those terms. But I think of PR as more of a system it's an entire system of legitimacy making, whereby they're creating the conditions in which certain kinds of communication appear legitimate or certain kinds of solutions appear legitimate, and others get totally marginalized or made invalid or made to seem economically infeasible. So, in the next question, I can talk a little bit more about how they do that, but I think it's really important to keep in mind that, you know, the conversations that we have about, say, carbon accounting are often corporate-fueled ideas. And I wonder sometimes why we are even entertaining those ideas when we should be thinking more about the extent to which corporations have underwritten those ideas.
Okay, we'll get to that more deeply. So, Jenny, a lot of food and agriculture reporting for you, and you know what I'm going to ask you about. Let's talk about Kernza.
Okay.
What is it? How has it been presented as a solution? Kind of in your mind, how does it stand for a bigger issue?
Yeah, so Kernza is a perennial grain, and I think I was actually Googling Kernza last night, as one does, it seems like it's gotten a little better, actually, but it felt like periodically you would see these sort of like, Kernza is going to save the world, Kernza's going to, like, so, you know, fix the climate crisis, because, you know, the sort of claim for it is like it's, you don't have to like till it, you don't have to harvest it every season, and it has these like long growing roots. Like, I don't know how many of you know about Kernza, but like the scientists behind it will like show up with these big
roots, and it's like super impressive to look at and everything. The problem is, I guess, like in a nutshell, is that, you know, the yields for it, they've been working on it for like 20 years. So every journalist like discovers Kernzon is like, ooh, and then it's like, oh, that was like 3 years ago there was an article on Kernzon, it's still in development, and like there's a beer, and like someone made some cookies, but it's not gonna replace wheat because wheat has like massive yields. That's the big problem, is I think like what happens in, again and again in a lot of these stories, like generative agriculture, for example, is we're not looking at like, we have a growing population, a growing local population, and sort of all these calorie needs, and does the replacement, does the solution actually, you know, produce enough, the same amount of yields without using like massive amounts of land, you know, so that's, and land is a huge climate cost. So this is often what's not in a lot of the reporting. And I think when you came across a certain rant of mine, and I just like, I don't think I even explained myself, but I was just like, it turns off. Because I was in that moment a little PO, because I think I had seen a big glowing article about Kernzon and its cookies and pancakes, and no like interrogation of like, okay, it's supposed to replace conventional wheat, and like it hasn't really been moving along despite the like decades that they've been working on it. I do want to say caveat that perennial rice is apparently doing a little better. So if anyone wants a little like go after perennial rice or something, apparently the yields are a little closer there. But just a tip. You asked for tips, so
perennial rights.
We come across the stories all the time. Like roof gardens aren't going to solve the climate crisis. Neither is vertical farming. You know.
Well, they will say just to caveat that, like there's no one thing that's going to solve the climate crisis. So that doesn't mean you shouldn't cover it because of that. And I'm not saying that it's more. And I think that's where it gets really complicated and interesting. Is like for every solution, like how much of the problem does it solve and what role does it play, especially with something like emissions and food system emissions, food related emissions, when you're not going to solve it with one thing. And so like what role does that solution play? That's like where I think like is the key. It doesn't mean don't cover it, it's just like don't have necessarily the headline that's going to do everything, you know.
Yeah, well, we can all blame our editors for those headlines.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Okay, so let's get out of doom and gloom and go towards something actionable, Brianna. So how, these problems are so systematic, how do we situate these smaller solutions against these bigger problems?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge part of this challenge, right? Like, we talk about climate change on the global level, that's really hard for any of us to fathom, right? Like, we do not function on the global level. We do not interact with the world on that scale. Like, we live our lives in our small little bubbles. And so I think on a certain level, we need to break down the problem to that level at which we live our everyday lives, right? The level at which we can participate in solutions. And I think a huge part of that is acknowledging that communities know their own problems best and are the best people to solve them, and that there is no cookie cutter solution. We can't just have like Kernza in every community, right? That's not gonna solve every community's problems. It is so much more individualized than that. So yes, it is a global problem. It's huge. It has to be addressed like on a large scale, but I think it needs to be like made up of many individual solutions created by and for the communities themselves. That makes it feel super impossible, but I think that's kind of what we try to do with our stories, is like look at a microcosm, have a sense of like how this community has identified their own problem and solved it, as a way to get other people to think about their own communities and the ways in which they, like, would that solution still apply to them? Would it not? What would need to change? Like, and being really honest about, like, these are not, we can't be naive, right? We can't just like look through rose-colored glasses and be like, ta-da, this is the solution. Like, solution stories need to talk about like the failed solutions. We need to talk about like the hurdles in getting there. We need to talk about the lessons learned and the really messy stuff that came before there was any progress, because otherwise it's just unrealistic. Like that's not how things work. And so I think there has to be a certain level of honesty, and we do need to report on failed solutions too. I think that's like, everybody wants a successful solution story, but like, I don't know what percent of solutions actually succeed, but it's not high, right? So, like, to avoid communities just replicating failures, I think it's important to report on the solutions and the failed solutions such that we can skip some of that, like, early failure work before communities can actually get toward something that works for them. Like, save them the time of learning those same hard lessons themselves.
Absolutely. Learn from our mistakes.
Learn from other people's mistakes, but you don't have to make them.
Even better. Since I didn't have the microphone closed last time, in case anyone's interested in failed solutions, I just did finish a book for Iowa Press about this topic. It'll be out this Halloween. It's called Over the Seawall. On that topic. Okay, so as I've been looking more and more into, you know, trying to find journalists who have experience with solutions journalists and have been willing to air some concerns about it publicly, one thing I've noticed is a lot of journalists who I have found that are somewhat critical, or at least, you know, raise their concerns, are not in the U.S. They're often overseas, often in places like India, where you encounter some of these, the impacts of climate change more profoundly, really honestly, than you do in the U.S. And within the U.S., you often find on front lines communities where there's higher levels of pollution or food deserts and all things like this. And so, you know, Yes Magazine really makes the effort to highlight those stories. And I wonder, how do you situate solution stories when, you know, in front lines communities? How do you make sure the solution you're writing about for a front lines community actually affects, works for the front lines community, isn't just, you know, a promotional scheme from some business that you're not aware of?
Yeah, we have to be really vigilant. And I think at the very foundation, with every story, it's like, I need to ask who the story is being written for. Because I think that is a critical part of knowing how the story, like, if it's actually a meaningful story, right? So who's defining the problem and who's proposing the solution? Like, if it's not from the community itself, it's probably not a meaningful solution. Like, we have stopped, we no longer reference carbon footprints in our stories because we understand that, like, it's not about individual carbon footprints, but, like, systemically, it's not individuals who are causing the problem, right? It's our system. It is these corporations. It is capitalism. And I think, like, Yes Magazine gets a reputation of being a little, like, yay, we're going to make the world better. And we just want to burn shit down so we can build something better, right? So, like, there's a certain understanding that, like, the systems aren't working. We're not going to innovate our way out of these problems unless we address the underlying inequities that are directing everyone's lives. I came to Yes from Popular Science, and I was very excited about, like, we're going to, you know, report on the solutions and talk about the innovations and the scientific breakthroughs. And I no longer believe that that is going to be what makes positive change. It's like, we need to fix the social disparities. We need to fix the distribution. And so I think that getting back to, like, stories themselves, I almost never write about scientific innovation anymore. I almost never write about, like, anything that involves buying anything, right? Like, because we just know that's not how it happens. And so most of the stories we're trying to assign are reporters coming from the communities themselves, able to, you know, tell that story in a meaningful way. Is the process of reporting one of extraction, where a reporter is going in, they're taking quotes, they're taking stories, they're taking experiences, and then writing the story they already have in mind? Like, that's not serving that community, right? And whose voices are in the story? I think so often, especially coming from a background in science journalism, we're told to listen to experts, and that's usually academics, and I really appreciate academic experts, and, like, incredibly valuable. But I also think we need to include the fact that people are experts in their own lived experience, and that does make them an expert. That does make them worthy of inclusion. And I'd much rather have somebody speaking their own truth about their community rather than, you know, thinking about the value of a source as their academic credentials. White saviorism is, like, rampant in these spaces, and, like, I'm a white woman. I need to own that and be very aware of the bias I'm bringing. So, like, the stories the stories need to make sure we're doing justice to the communities we're covering, and that means that we have to be on guard for, you know, a lot of the tropes of solutions journalism and a lot of the naivete that often comes in that space. So, yeah, I could go on, but I might just end there.
That's great. Yeah. I appreciate that. I was talking about experts. It's interesting that you moved away from covering scientific, you know, breakthroughs, and that's I find that really fascinating. We can talk more about that. I want to get to Melissa because I want to talk about, you know, greenwashing and wokewashing and this idea of who is really an expert about these things. So you mentioned fossil fuel companies before, but fossil fuel companies are obviously, you know, very aware of their image in the public domain. How do they position themselves as solving rather than causing the climate crisis?
I think we need to think about that question in a larger framework than we usually do, in the sense that if we look at individual initiatives by companies who are arguing that they can solve the climate crisis, we look, for example, at the Greenhouse Gas Protocol, or GHG Protocol. The GHG Protocol is considered the global gold standard of corporate-level reporting on emissions. It's made up of a wide variety of benchmarking indices, risk analysis, greenhouse gas accounting, and many, if not most, of the Fortune 500 companies now use the Greenhouse Gas Protocol directly or indirectly as a standard for measuring their greenhouse gas emissions. But this matters even if you're not covering or talking about the Greenhouse Gas Protocol itself, because of the knock-on effect of that protocol. So the protocol standards affect a lot of other factors like ESG disclosure reports, investor confidence in the industry's net zero planning, analyzing the offsets produced on voluntary carbon markets. So if we think about the protocol, we think about all of the standards and the guidelines and the calculation tools that make up this protocol, these have essentially become the rules by which corporations measure their success at achieving climate goals and then present their success as, you know, solutions to the climate crisis. But these are rules made by corporations. So there's a self-fulfilling prophecy here, and it's, you know, my sense is that the context in which those conversations take place, again, are so shot through with this kind of influence that, this, back to the question you asked me before, that I think sometimes journalists just don't have the means to understand that the PR effect is so strong already in the kinds of evidence that they're looking for. Another example, one I think about a lot, is that there was reporting in the Washington Post and elsewhere that this year's COP27 conference, past years, had 636 lobbyists for the oil and gas industry registered, which is 25% more than were at COP26 in Glasgow. And major PR firms are doing all of the publicity for that conference. So the entire event, again, is kind of infused with this corporate sponsorship and this marketing and PR. So how do journalists separate out the solutions that are being expressed at that conference from the impact of the ongoing participation of the fossil fuel industry in these events? And I want to stress, again, that's just one, you know, that's just a couple of examples. Like, it's much broader than that. It has to do with even the level of partnerships with environmental organizations, sponsorship of public events, educational initiatives. There was just a great story in the Washington Post last week about climate denier group, CO2 Coalition, that was handing out comic books at a National Science Teachers Convention as educational materials for these teachers to use. They handed out about 700 of them before they got kicked out. So, you know, there's a lot of sponsorship by the fossil fuel industry of the contexts of education, culture, what have you, that we find ourselves in.
Livestock industry,
yeah.
Livestock industry also at all
yeah.
these events, yeah.
Yeah, let's go to that. I mean, yeah. As editors who are fielding pitches and signing articles, do you trust business solutions? And
Do you have maybe like a mental checklist that you use when a reporter comes to you with this great solution story and you have to discern like, ooh, is that, do I really want to publish this? Is this legit?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I mean, I will say like it goes, basically every company pitch, you know, any industry pitch, whether it's, like, I know I'm a huge believer in, I'm like, could eat impossible meat all day long, but like, I know when I get an industry pitch, like I am going to be scrutinizing that, I always say that, you know, now that I'm an editor, funnily enough, after my rants on solutions journalism, I often say, why not cover that from a solutions lens? And by that, I mean, like, tell me what's not working. Like, tell me where the gaps are. It's tough for people. I think I have noticed a lot of writers then, they're all in on the solution, or they've done all this reporting, and they're leaving it by the time they're going to pitch it. I'm not sure, but I often get, like, it doesn't show up sometimes in the draft. For, I don't know why, actually. Maybe they're more positive than me or more optimistic. I don't know, because I start from a point of like, well, like, what are the holes, like, you know? Like, so, yeah. I was just editing it on, like, there's been a lot of, it's always new. Like, there's a new solution every other, you know, month or whatever, and it seems like I've had a few pitches of, like, seaweed, like, we're going to just grow it up to feed everybody. And it's like, oh, okay, but like, you know, but in what space in the ocean, like, that are suitable for that, and what, like, there's so many holes, but like, yet we have these like sweeping claims coming out, you know, either from industry or sometimes from, we talked about this a little bit before, but like researchers, sometimes the PR arm of like, you know, an academic institution kind of like touting the study as bigger than it actually is. And I think those are the holes that we, as journalists, need to be looking for, you know, and be extremely skeptical whenever it's an industry solution and somebody from a company pitching you, like, of course.
Brianna, do you have any kind of a checklist or kind of a roadmap you use for identifying these hurdles?
Yeah, I mean, I would say a lot of it is sort of like, it starts with an initial gut check. Like, if I read a pitch and I've got that like saccharine aftertaste in my mouth, like, I'm not gonna touch that story. I think the first thing I would say is the writer proposing to talk to the people who would be impacted by this solution? And is it far enough along that they can actually see if it's making an impact in their lives? So I think a lot of solution stories get pitched at the idea phase. Like, this is a really cool way that we can address this problem. But like, and we need ideas. We absolutely need ideas. There needs to be like copious amounts of ideas being tried all the time. But like, I think that impact is a really important part to being able to assess the viability of an idea. I think, as I mentioned before, honestly talking about the hurdles, you know, the ways in which this is challenging or not going to work out or not scalable. I think, you know, any hint of white saviorism out, technological solutions, scientific innovations, usually not gonna pass up for me personally at yes. Because I think I want to cover the solutions that are addressing underlying systemic inequities that are shaping our society, that are perpetuating the discrepancies and, you know, just making our world the way it is and all these beautiful problems we have.
Would you think differently if you were still at PopSci?
I was not allowed to think differently at PopSci. I would sometimes pitch climate solutions and I would get the pushback that like, oh, that's about reproductive justice, that's a women's issue, we're a men's magazine, not going to talk about that. This can't be off the record. Now you all know. But then I was also like, I had to write about warships that were being designed because that's what our readers wanted to read about. Like, that is not making our world a better place. Like, and I think we need to just be, we were talking a little bit about like, is the role of a journalist changing in our world today? And I think I have had a lot of deep reflection and feelings on that in my transition, like transition away from like legacy media to Yes Media. I was very uncomfortable at first. I was really uncomfortable. I was like, this feels like activism, you guys. And they're like, we call racism racism? That's not activism, that's just like accurately reporting on the reality of our world. And I was like, you know, I don't know, this doesn't feel realistic. And they're like, well, the world is very depressing, and yes, we could focus on that, but there's also really amazing things happening in the world. Like, that's not newsworthy by traditional standards, but like, why aren't we also talking about that? Why can't we, you know, show a more realistic vision of what's happening in the world and also a vision of what we want it to be? Like, is that activism? I don't know answers. I do not have answers to this, but it has made me really question my role as a journalist and what's like, as an editor, I'm deciding, I'm curating the stories that we're publishing, and that really defines the impact that we have and who we're writing for and who we're writing to and how our stories impact the world. And even just basic things, like we publish our stories under a Creative Commons license. Like, I'm not trying to scoop anybody. I'm not trying to like beat anybody to the story. Like, I'm trying to tell a story and I want as many people as possible to read it. Like, that collaborative nature feels like that's more in line with my values as a journalist.
I want to come back to that, because I think that's, we might end on that question. But before we get to it, there's a couple other things I want to jump into first. One is this issue of editors, like I think you brought this up, Jenny, editors asking journalists, reporters, especially freelancers, to confront a story from a solutions angle. And I wonder if any of you have ever been confronted with that. I personally have had written stories about very complex issues and then have an editor at the end ask, can we throw on a solution? Because this feels very dark. Like, we need to find a way to lighten it up a bit for our readers. And I wonder, have you experienced that?
Yeah. I was actually, as a freelancer, writing a piece for a solutions newsletter. And the piece was actually critical. So it was about like why organic agriculture isn't necessarily a climate solution. But the editors did want there to be like, well, what else then? What is the solution? And Kiss the Ground, a movie about regenerative ag, had just come out, and the editor was like obsessed with it and was sort of like, well, then this is going to solve everything, obviously. And I had been talking to some researchers at World Resource Institute, kind of knew their criticisms of that, but I got a lot of pushback, basically, of wanting to not have like necessarily a neat solution for it. Like, you know, there's a lot of big, like, is it sustainable intensification? Or, like, you know, what is the solution? But I feel like I'm not sure that those big terms are so helpful. So I got a lot of pushback, and it was tough.
I mean, Brianna, as a nonprofit, you're dependent on grants and donations, and there's a lot of money in solution journalism today. Or there's the Solution Journalism Network that supplies funding, grants up to $5,000, one that I'm aware of. And there's a lot of fellowships and jobs and awards. More and more these days seem to be kind of gearing toward the solutions world. Do you ever feel pressure to be writing solution stories to maintain a revenue stream?
No. There's not enough money in it. I feel like people come to us with stories when they pitch them elsewhere and everyone else has turned them down because nobody wants to talk about solutions. Like, I feel like that's what often happens, is like, this wasn't investigative enough, or it wasn't like people. I would say that people come to us specifically with solution stories because it's the story they want to tell, not because there is money there. We do not have an excess of money. That is a true statement. But I also don't know many newsrooms who do. And often, if you do, you're beholden to someone. And I don't know. I guess I'd rather be like needing to write about solutions than like, I don't know, being in the pocket of fossil fuels or something. Mm. advertisers, for example. Like, we don't have ads. That's nice. That's a nice change.
Got it.
That's great. Right now?
Are you going to take questions from me?
I'm absolutely going to take questions. I'm trying to leave 15 minutes for it. Is that going to be enough?
That'll handle one question.
Real quick, because I think this stuff is fascinating. Something like we're just going to light speed ahead now, because I had a whole line of questions for you guys. Anyway, big data. Tell me about big data and its role, because this is, I think, a fascinating bit of your research that I think journalists should be aware of.
Very briefly. I have an article out with the co-author Maria Espinoza. It's called Climate Action for Big Data or Big Data for Climate Action. And the idea behind it is that, as the title implies, a lot of companies justify their ongoing collection and use of consumer data by trying to repurpose it as good for the climate. For example, Waze, the driving app, the navigation app, has argued that it can use the data that it collects on users, so if there's a flood, it can redirect people away. Facebook has also justified its use of big data. They call it data for good. You might have heard this expression, data for good, or sometimes called data philanthropy. It's very popular among corporations who, again, are just trying to find another use for their big data and also sidestep being regulated. So that's...
big data is often promoted as the big solution to climate change. I mean, is that really true?
Is it? I mean, is big data promoted as the solution to climate change?
You don't think so?
By corporations or by...
Yes.
No, I think it's one of many. I think it's one of many. Maybe one thing I could, to qualify this, corporations are always working on 15 strategies at a time. They're never putting all of their eggs in one basket. So big data is one. Companies that are not fossil fuel companies, but that are data and tech companies, are often the ones who I think are most invested in this idea of big data for climate action. But you're also going to see the standard lobbying. You're also going to see partnerships or alliance building, the relations in public relations with all kinds of like-minded groups that share their interests, groups with whom they can work to act as mouthpieces for their interests so that it doesn't appear as the corporation itself is speaking on the climate issue. So there's a variety of different strategies. I think big data is just one of them.
Okay, so now we're gonna jump right into questions. I bet there's a bunch of them. And SEJ members first, journalists and SEJ members first, yeah? A question, please, don't just give me a statement. And identify yourselves when you go to do that. Sorry.
My name is Cynthia Barnett. I'm an environmental author, and I also teach environmental journalism at the University of Florida. My question is, why do we call it solutions journalism? By the way, thank you for this panel. It's terrific. I was so happy to see it.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah, really great panel. Why are we calling it solutions journalism? Because when I listen to you two talk, it sounds like you're describing the best journalism. You remind me of Ida Tarbell, the early investigative reporter who investigated Standard Oil, and those are the shoulders on which we stand. So why is this solutions journalism? Why isn't it just good journalism that all journalists should be striving for?
That hasn't been what I have done in other newsrooms. It's a good question. It should just be the norm. It should be the standard expectation.
Yeah. Ditto. I agree. Peter Fairley. I'm a freelance journalist based in San Francisco and Victoria, BC. I'm curious how I loved your example of the grain. I can't feed the world. But when I started writing about solutions, climate change solutions 25 years ago, and wanted to write about energy and pitch stories on solar, it was laughably expensive and inefficient. And I had no hope of changing the world according to the top experts. The world has a funny way of evolving. And I guess, how do you decide whether something is not worthy of coverage
Can I just say quickly on that one? Like, actually, that's how we kind of cover cultivated meat, because I feel like it is important to keep talking about. Like, there's a lot of promise there. It's like, you know, currently only on the market, like Singapore or something, like in a super expensive restaurant. So what we try to do is then say, like, okay, what's the price right now? Also, like, it, you know, the modeling is speculative, this is not being operating at scale, and like, but you know, the emissions are like, to match beef, and like, how does it do against chicken? Like, we really get into the details. And I think that's how you have to do it, unless it's just like, I don't know, something that just has no, it's like totally, you know, has no reality, no place in reality. But I think, like, especially if there's an industry, like a huge, you know, growing cultivated meat industry or some industry, it's like, let's scrutinize that. Like, how much money is going in, who's going out of business? All these things, I think, are like ripe for interrogation.
Go to the side.
So, my name is James Gaines. I'm a freelancer from Seattle. So I worry that with solutions journalism, especially a treadmill of maybe more Pollyanna things, where we propose a solution or we try to cover a solution that then fails, that this might have an effect on the reach of trust in solution journalism as a whole. That after being promised so many different things that might fix a problem after many years and the systemic problems are still there, that people will just tune out. Has there been research on public trust, and should there be?
Well, there's certainly, I couldn't give you an actual number, but there's certainly plenty of research on public trust and journalism in general.
Right.
And it's been plummeting, right? I found that very interesting. Personally, it's one of the reasons I want to talk about this, because it seems like as more and more, like I said, these number of hundreds of newsrooms, thousands of journalists getting involved in solutions journalism with the idea of helping to build some trust in journalism again. At the same time, the Pew Research Center consistently tells me that public trust in journalism is falling.
Do you think it's a different story for solutions journalism in particular?
I don't know. I wouldn't have anything factual back, any comment up on that, honestly. That's a really good question.
I will just say that I trust people who are honest, like, generally. So if we kind of stick to that and are honest in our coverage, I feel like that goes a long way in creating trust.
Thank you.
This would be okay.
Michael Kodas, senior editor of Inside Climate News and SCGA board member. The Solutions Journalism Network, people that kind of define solutions journalism for us, gets rather irritated if you present the idea of investigating and scrutinizing solutions as being a solution in and of itself.
That's what we call instructive failure, and that's a key part of solutions journalism, is looking at what the response is, what the limitations are, and if it's a failed solution, it still can be a solution journalism story. And to the point that the woman made at the beginning, it's called solutions journalism for lack of a better term. It's reporting on the response, which, as you pointed out, is what good journalism is.
I've had another solutions journalism member interrupt me just like that and criticize me for pointing for advertise or pushing that. Maybe my phrasing was different. But my question is, how do you all select solutions in this era of carbon capture and sequestration and direct air capture and solving climate change with kelp farms? How do you select solutions that really merit investigation so that we don't waste a lot of resource and time on things that are not going to, move the climate needle in the direction that we would like?
I mean, I think you need to look at what values a solution is proposing. I've definitely done stories on seaweed because it's developing food sovereignty for native communities. So, like, I don't think we're going to solve the world's food issues with seaweed, right? But, like, it can address a problem, and it is making things incrementally better in terms of the climate. And so I don't think we're going to know what the next solar is, necessarily, right? I think we can do some cursory research and figure out what's not the next solar, maybe. Maybe that's the same problem that we was having 25 years ago. I guess I just feel like coverage isn't bad. Like, if we're covering something and it doesn't pan out, shucks. But, like, let's just cover the ideas and see how they're working and follow up with them. I mean, I think there's some value in that. These are global problems. We've never functioned on this scale and managed to make positive change. But like, we are the cause of the problem, so we should be trying at least.
I think it's the framing is so important because like you said about seaweed. So like, there's a difference between, you know, a community agriculture effort, I guess, to grow seaweed, and then like an industry, like a startup who's just like, oh, we're gonna scale this up. And also we're gonna be feeding, I mean, I don't want to say like everyone's saying we're feeding the world anymore, like, but like we're gonna do that, but really we're gonna make our money on feed additives for cattle and, you know, misrepresent the science there. And like, that's where I think, but both of those are good stories, right? Like, I think it's how you frame it. So yeah, and I agree with you, like more coverage is good. As long as it's like really interrogating the evidence and framing it properly, framing the solution. Probably, I'd say. And different
outlets,
we're
going to
define that differently, which is good.
All right, like blue shirt?
Me?
I think it's blue, yeah.
I'm a reporter at Grist. And I have a question about a sort of like what you talked about when it comes to sort of not solutions as a solution story, like this isn't a solution. I remember reporting on Exxon's algae initiative, and I called their headquarters and asked them sometimes to point me to their algae division, and they didn't know what I was talking about. And they just shuttered that initiative, right? But I don't think my reporting had anything to do with that. Like, Exxon is sort of untouchable in that way. So I guess I'm wondering, how do you measure impact when it comes to that, like, this is not a solution story?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think generally when I look to impact and how to measure it, it's like, how is it impacting the people it's supposed to help? And like, that Exxon algae project was never designed to help anybody. And so like, I don't know, sometimes just pointing out that they're trying to do these false things is the story, right? Just like, no comment is like saying a lot, right? In the same way that like, yeah. So I think sometimes the story can speak for itself. Sometimes we don't give readers enough credit to be like, look how transparently bullshit this is.
On that Exxon biofuels story, I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that if they spent $350 million on the research for algae biofuels, they spent half that advertising it. So I think that in itself is the story right there.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yes.
Hi, my name is Ellen. I'm in NYU's Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program. My question is primarily for Brianna and Jenny, but as an early career person, it seems like we often talk about reporting on solutions and reporting on problems as two very separate things. But I'm curious about the ways that we can incorporate the story of solutions into our reporting on problems and addressing their pitfalls, the nuances, but just making sure that those are also included in stories about problems when maybe they don't take the form of the whole narrative, but still play an important role.
I mean, I don't think we can talk about the solutions if we're not talking about the problems, right? So I do think a story should include both. Can you repeat like the crux of the question?
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering, when reporting on a major issue, should it be our industry standard to always incorporate solutions in that reporting to address them, flesh out their nuance? Highlights any issues with them? Should we always be highlighting those?
No, I think anytime you like formulaically say story must include ABC, like that's where we get into trouble. So there are definitely stories where there just isn't a solution, and we publish those stories too. And I think that the other thing is that don't go into reporting a story thinking you know what the story is. I think in many cases, the important thing is to say, like, I got a pitch, I worked with a writer, they reported the story, it didn't pan out the way they thought. I was recently working on a story with a Tlingit reporter, and he was talking about a canoe center that's being built in Seattle as like a cultural revitalization. It seemed like a really positive solution, like the community wanted and needed this, but as he was reporting, like it turned out that the community had asked for like supporting services and like huge amounts of land, and then what the city did was like, here, you can have this little community center. So like it wasn't a solution story, and we like had to re-report it and do the story over because the story he thought he was going to report wasn't the reality. And so I think that's the other thing, is just being open to like, when you talk to people, you might find out that the story is not what you thought it was, and especially editors need to be okay with that. Like, we need to be excited to pivot when the story is different than we went into it. So I think that's part of it. That's but great. No formulate anything.
That's a great answer. Actually.
My name is Emily Atkin. I write a climate change newsletter called Heated, and really focus on accountability journalism, which is something that I actually consider to be solutions journalism. And I think that probably the elephant in the room that I don't think we've really talked about in here is the responsibility of the fossil fuel industry and like a big ag. But I feel like we've been talking a lot about solutions, like what a corporation is doing, or what a person can do, or what about this technology. And I'm just wondering about the role of solutions journalism that focuses on collective action to like actually fight systemic problems. I feel like so much solution journalism is a response to the problem journalism, just not calling that out explicitly. You know, like being like, oh, the gloom and doom story, climate change, it is human caused. Oh, it's humans. Which humans, right? Like, if we were just more explicit in our problem stories about which humans are causing it, perhaps we wouldn't need so much, scrambling solution journalism to make you feel better. You would know immediately sort of collective action is needed. So I would say, like, do you think there's a reason that, like, we haven't really talked about that yet? Do you think that accountability journalism is included in solutions journalism?
I just wanted to jump in and say I did have thoughts on this that I hadn't shared in an earlier question, but protest is something that we think a lot about at YES, and like how that should play. And one of the things that we try to do very differently than other media outlets is that protest, like the language we use, protests are often, the coverage is about what laws are being broken, how much money is being lost, what sort of economic things are being interrupted, as opposed to like realizing that they're doing this because they're looking for a platform and we offer no other opportunities for them to be heard. What is the message they're trying to send? What is it that they are asking for? What is the situation that is requiring this? And I think that's a big part of it is like, I think protesters and collective action is often like swept under the rug as this like young, idealistic, like unrealistic way to approach the world. But I think it's so critical to be able to say like, this is happening, this action is trying to like call out the ways in which corporations are doing it. And I think at a base level, there needs to be an acceptance that like a lot of these problems exist because of capitalism, and we're not going to solve them within the confines of capitalism. And so that is often a message of like protesters or, you know, these like radical outside voices. But I think it's a really important part of bringing to account the people, the organizations, these systems that are actually perpetuating these harms very intentionally, very actively, at great cost.
Yeah, I just want to corroborate that. I'm a huge fan of the idea that accountability is a climate solution. And I wonder if there's a way to, you know, if we encourage people to contact their congressional representative, to look into corporate greenwashing in their locality, calling for transparency and solutions, I think that helps. It helps if the readers understand that they can be part of that, that they don't have to wait for larger institutions or larger groups to call for accountability and transparency, but that there are ways for them to do it, supporting lawsuits against greenwashing campaigns, and reading about how, like you're, exactly as you're saying, how problems came about in the first place, what role in my case, corporations, because that's what I think about all the time, but how groups like corporations or other anti-climate or, you know, alternative climate solution actors have intervened in those problems and then offering solutions on that basis to respond to it. Sometimes that kind of awareness is a way that people can feel like they're part of the solution.
I just want to say one thing. I totally agree with all of that, and I will also say that one complexity, I think, for food and ag is that, like, also individual dietary change does need to happen. Like, so we do need to be talking about both, but we and we're a very small outlet, but we do try to in terms of, like, any of our, you know, take action solutions part of it, we do try to address the collective action side of it, and then also, like, household change and the research behind that, like, what are effective household changes, household level changes. I don't think it's one or the other, obviously, but, like, yes, I'm very worried, like, personal carbon footprint and all that stuff, so just that caveat we all need.
Okay, I think we have time for one more, but it's got to be fast. They were the gray sweater.
Yes.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Rowan Starling. I'm a freelance journalist based in New York. And this is something that I think Brianna started to touch on earlier. I'm curious to know about solutions that are in their very early stages where we haven't talked about, you know, if we haven't quite seen the impact yet. But what if there's a lot of problems? What if we've talked to a lot of these experts, no matter who those experts are, who speak to those, to the promise of this, you know, very beginning stage project. Should we be covering those stories at all? What precautions should we be taking during our pre-recording, and how should we be framing those stories?
I was just gonna say, yes, I think we need to report on things at every stage of the process, as long as we're clear about the caveats of, like, what we know and what we don't know. I think the danger zone is when we report on these early stage projects with, like, the promise of feeding the world or the promise of, you know, big grand outcomes that we can't possibly foresee and, you know, have not been borne out. So I think sort of caveats are really a really critical thing for early stage.
And I will add on that, like one thing that I think is often not appreciated in food and ag coverage is that everything is a trade-off, and often things that are, like, really solve one problem may exacerbate another problem. And so I just like coverage that brings that all out. Like, you don't have to answer everything. We're just journalists, but, like, raise the questions and, like, air all that out and think about it from different angles. And hopefully your editor should support you in raising those, you know, issues.
Okay, it's noon. They want us all to go to the ballroom. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for the panel.